This is going to be a very different message because there are going to be lots of pictures. And I'm hoping that I won't be blocking too many for the view for too many of you. I tried standing over there, and I still blocked it for people there. So if I can get my computer open, if you're in a place where you can't see the pictures, please don't hesitate to get up and move and get to a place. If you want to do that, you don't have to do that. I am going to be telling lots of stories, and every one of the stories is in this book. And I'm bringing this up because it's called The Curse of Bungalow Falls. I'm not ashamed to promote this here in the church because the money doesn't go to me. The money is going to go for missions. So if you buy one of these books, I pray that you will be enormously blessed. I pray that your children will hear God's call, and that you will give it to others as well. So this morning, I want to talk about sending the light and how it happens, as well as how God does it, our part and God's part. And all comes because the last words that Jesus gave to his church, to his disciples, before he ascended into heaven, he said, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. So how are we doing? This is a map from the Joshua Project, which you can go to online. It's a website which tracks people groups around the world and reports on their access to the gospel. They do this as a service to the body of Christ worldwide to help prioritize prayer and mission efforts. The red dots represent people groups that are totally unreached. The yellow and green dots represent different degrees of reached, and dark green indicates significantly reached. As you will see, India is the place that is the darkest red. Part of that reason is because no missionaries are allowed there anymore. They're persecuted very severely. Even Christians are persecuted in India by the Hindu religion. But there are some great churches in India, and they are expanding very rapidly. So God has his own plan, even if we can't get in there and send missionaries there. So who should send the light of Jesus to the rest of the world? Should it be the biggest churches in the world? And there are some huge ones. Should it be the little churches? Because, you know, they're in the places where the gospel needs to be proclaimed the most, right? Well, actually, the answer is all churches, including, of course, Westside Church of Reading. And as part of that effort, we are helping to support the three international workers for their safety. We can't put their names or pictures up on the screen, but you can see their photos and newsletters on the little table there in the back. We are supporting these three, but there are others from among this congregation who could go to where Christ is not known. If they went, would we support them? I'm sure we would in prayer, but would we, and would we read their newsletters if they went? Would we support them financially? These are all questions that we have to consider as we talk about being obedient to Christ's last command. How much impact can one man or one woman make? Hudson Taylor was one of the most influential Christian missionaries of all time, starting his ministry in China in 1832 and serving for over 50 years. He founded the China Inland Mission, which grew to more than 800 missionaries. Taylor was the first Western missionary to dress like the Chinese and wear his hair in a pigtail, a decision that endeared him to the Chinese he was trying to reach with the gospel, but provoked other missionaries to mock him. Hudson Taylor, a great man of God. Now, this is a photo of Becky and me at the gravestone of Oswald Chambers. Now, and the question is, how much of the world can just one life illuminate? So we found Oswald Chambers' grave in a Cairo cemetery for British soldiers. I've shared his story with you before, but it's so inspiring that it's worth retelling, especially in light of what we're talking about today. He was born on July 24th in 1874 in Aberdeen, Scotland. In his teens, he was a remarkably gifted artist. I mean, it was incredible what he was able to do without any training. And he was convinced the Lord was going to use his skills as an artist for his glory. But in his late teens, he sensed that the Lord was leading him into something greater than his artistic talent. And he put that love away. Some will say that's a tragedy, but instead, God called him to be a sender of his light. And it was in an unusual way. Now, it was a very hard decision for him to stop with his art, but he next made a decision that changed his life, and that was to be discipled by a wonderful godly man for the next 9 years. There wasn't a Bible school at that time near him, but this man was knew his scriptures back and forth. And for the next 9 years, he studied under the mentorship of this Scottish pastor. Eventually then, Oswald heard God's call, and he didn't have any way of becoming a missionary at that point, so he opened a school to train young men to be the light of Jesus to the world. Now, Oswald Chambers was had a remarkable intellect at this time, and many flocked to hear him and to join this Bible school. Eventually, he trained 106 Bible students to become missionaries. 40 of them became missionaries, 106 Bible school students, but he trained and sent out 40 missionaries. Not bad for a start. A lot of people would say, well, that's good, you know, he did his job, he was finished. Of course, the greatest missionary of all time is Jesus Christ. And he has called us to be the light of the world, not the voice of the world, not the silent majority. How are we doing with that assignment? Well, there's good news. The Joshua Project recently reported that great progress has occurred in the last 50 years. In 1974, an estimated 61% of the world lived in frontier people groups that had less than 0.1% of Christians among them. As of 2025, that number has dropped to 24% of the world. 61% down to 24%. We are making incredible progress in reaching the world with the gospel. But it's not the time to say we're nearly done. Let me go back now to the question about the importance of one missionary. What happens when one missionary, one, obeys God's call? And you may be thinking, well, you know, this is a small church. We can't make that big of an impact if we send out one more missionary. But just wait. This is my grandpa Stebbins. You see him sitting there, and I'm on his lap with my sister Judy. The other adults are there are his two of his daughters. This picture was taken in 1949. One of those daughters was my mother. The other was an aunt. Both of them married men who had been called by God and had heard God's call to become missionaries. So then they were four, plus my grandpa and grandmother. That goes six. But actually, it started with my grandmother, one, because she was a missionary kid. Her parents were missionaries to the West Indies. We won't count them. We'll count my grandmother as number one in the Stebbins family of missionaries. She went to Bible school, met my grandfather, and convinced him that God was calling him to be a missionary too. So he went off, first of all, he was appointed to Hanoi, Vietnam with us two other men, and they were all single missionaries there. The women that they eventually married were all still in the Bible school, a school for missionary trainees, it was called back then. And when they got to Vietnam, It was the French were there, and they were the colonialists, and they all had Vietnamese girlfriends, even though many of them were married. And so when fathers of beautiful Vietnamese girls kept coming to the three missionary men and saying, we have a beautiful woman that could be your companion, they kept saying, no, we're not like those other guys. But it just got to be such a pain that they finally wrote to the mission headquarters and said, send us wives. One of the three was my grandmother. And they had met and talked, and so they came out, and all three couples married and had many children who became missionaries. I was one of them. Now, perhaps you're thinking right now, well, I could never do that. And I can understand how bizarre some of this sounds, but how well do you know God? He is a God full of surprises. Here's how I got involved. I was a year old when my parents arrived in Vietnam, and they spent a year learning French before they moved to Cambodia and learned over another year how to read, write, and speak Khmer, the script language of Cambodia's largest people group, which, by the way, Rachel reads, writes, and used to speak. 4 years earlier, though, World War II had ended, and France was trying to reimpose colonial rule over the countries of Cambodia, Vietnam, and Laos, but the people in these three countries were fighting for their independence. And in Cambodia, rebels were ambushing French military vehicles on the roads and killing every white person who looked French, and we looked very French. The car we had was that my parents were able to afford was a Willys Jeep, and so that it would not be, they wouldn't be misunderstood and thought to be French military, my dad painted it bright yellow with red hubcaps. Our mission assigned them to the Cambodian town of Krachek, and I'm going to show you a map in a bit about that, where that was, located on the Mekong River. The French military thought that my parents were crazy to attempt to drive to Krachek. It was a 7-hour drive on partially paved roads. They finally advised them, since they insisted on going, an officer said to them, all right, you're crazy, but drive as fast as you can and don't stop for anything because there are rebels in the forest waiting to ambush people. So my folks prayed for God's protection and started down the road in faith. When they were about halfway there to Krachek, they had a flat tire. And so my dad was frantically trying to quickly change the tire when a French army truck carrying soldiers drove by, and they didn't even stop to help, if you can believe that. And they went down the road about 50 yards and hit a landmine, blew up the truck, flipped it over, and rebels came out of the forest on both sides and killed everyone. Well, my dad finished changing that tire fast, you can be sure, and they turned around and went to the nearest town. But the next morning, they prayed again, and God said, go back. And so the next morning, they loaded up the Jeep, and they kept traveling, and they arrived in Krachek. Cambodia was a Buddhist country, and when my dad asked permission to start a church in Krachek, the Buddhist governor refused and said they couldn't have a Christian church within 15 kilometers of the town. It just so happened that the first village that they went to was where 8 years earlier, a missionary traveling to Laos had stopped for the night on his way and had led one man to faith in Jesus. Since then, that man had been praying every day and pleading with God to send another Christian to his village. God is always in charge. Perhaps you're thinking right now, well, that's a wonderful story. I could never do that. Well, one light was my father and one light was my mother, and they became two lights, and God multiplied them over and over again. But it started with just one. Well, Let me switch gears now in this story. Before Archie Mitchell was a missionary, he was a pastor of a church in Bly, Oregon, near not too far from Klamath Falls. One day when his first wife, not in this picture, was pregnant with their first child, the couple took 8 children on a church Sunday school picnic in the mountains near the town of Bly. What they didn't know was that a Japanese balloon bomb that had floated across the Atlantic Ocean had landed in their favorite picnic spot. As Archie and his unloaded the lunch from the back of his car, his wife and the kids ran ahead. In their excitement, one of the kids touched the bomb. It exploded, killing all the children and Archie's wife. That might be enough to discourage most people. Archie and his first wife had been planning to be missionaries. One of the children who was killed in the explosion had heard God's call to take the light of Jesus to the world. She was planning to do that. After her death, her older sister felt God calling her to her sister's place. When Archie heard of her decision, and her name was Betty, he came courting. And a year later, the two were married and were accepted by the Christian and Missionary Alliance to be missionaries. They arrived in Dalat, Vietnam, the same year that my parents arrived, and the two couples studied French together. That's also incidentally where, at age 1, I met Becky, my wife. Doesn't God have a great sense of humor? In 1962, after they had been in Vietnam as missionaries for more than 12 years, Archie and Betty were reassigned to head up a leprosy hospital near the city of Ban My Thuot in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. One night soon after, Viet Cong soldiers forced their way into their home, tied up Archie in front of his children, including Becky, and also tied up Dr. Vieri, the only doctor at the hospital for leprosy patients, and a young Mennonite missionary. They marched them into the jungle, and early the next morning, Betty and her kids notified the U.S. Army as quickly as they could, but despite helicopter searches and the efforts of U.S. Special Forces, Archie Mitchell and the other two missionaries were never seen or heard from again. Becoming a light to the world can be dangerous, and it can be heart-wrenching, but even the kidnapping of Betty Mitchell's husband did not stop her. She continued to shine the light of Jesus to the people of Vietnam and to the tribal people where she lived until the country fell in 1975. She was taken prisoner by the North Vietnamese Army before she could flee, marched up the Ho Chi Minh Trail until she collapsed, and was saved by the other prisoners who carried her. 8 months later, she was released and nearly died of malaria. After that, she served, but that wasn't the end. After that, she served in Malaysia for several more years as the cook at a mission school. When I was 14, I already knew Betty Mitchell and Archie Mitchell because they were my dorm parents before they went to the leprosy hospital. And I loved those people. They were like the best uncle and aunt you could ever have. But as we were driving to Cambodia's capital city so I could go back to school in Vietnam, we suddenly came on the scene of a terrible accident between a truck and a bus. Many were injured, mostly from it was a head-on collision, and so there were a lot of smaller injuries and broken bones and broken noses and so forth from the bus. But the most seriously injured was the truck driver, who back then nobody had seat belts. He was thrown against the steering wheel, and his chest was just crushed. People from the bus had taken him out of the truck and propped him against a tree to help him breathe, and nobody knew what to do. My father saw him, and we stopped, and he said, "Get the thermos, David." And he wasn't a doctor. I don't know what he thought he was going to do, but we went over there, and this man was just gasping for air. I'd never seen anything like this in my life, and my eyes were like this. And my father started talking to him, gave him some water to drink, but he couldn't drink. He was just gasping for air. His chest, all his ribs were broken. And so my father started sharing the gospel with him in Cambodian. My father was very fluent. And as he'd just gotten maybe spoken for a minute, and the man just shook his head. He was a Buddhist. He said, "Don't tell me about your God. Just help me." That was the most traumatic experience I had ever had. I'd never seen anything like it. And as we left him, we couldn't do anything. He died later, I'm sure. I kept thinking, if we could have only helped him. But that man's soul had gone to hell. And I was just heartbroken. And from that moment on, I began praying that God would allow me to become, to do something to help people before they died and tell them about Jesus. And that was my call to medical missions. That is how God called me to be a missionary doctor. Well, my parents, while all this was going through my head at the mission school, my parents one day had a delegation of chiefs from a Cambodian tribe called the Benom. And they came to our house in Cratchit. They had crossbows and spears and things through their noses and so forth, wore loincloths. But they explained that they had walked 100 miles because they had heard from the Khmer people that my parents were teaching in the church out in this village, that they had a book that told the story of what happened after the Great Flood. You see, they had in their history passed down orally for centuries the story of the flood. But they had lost the rest of the story. They knew that a great God had created the world, the animals, the stars, and the moon, and a man and a woman who had disobeyed God that led to a great evil in the world. Eventually, the Creator sent a great flood that drowned everybody except one man and his wife and his sons, and they built a boat big enough to save their family and many of the animals. But that was all they knew. And someone now had the rest of the story. So they invited my father to come to their villages in eastern Cambodia. That was not an easy thing because there were no roads there except logging roads. And the villages were spread over an area the size of Maine. Well, my folks started going to their villages. They would guide them through where there were no roads. If the road couldn't go any farther, then the village chiefs would send elephants. And there was my dad up there, and that one elephant, my mom rode on him too. I never did. I was at the mission school while all this fun was going on. They told the people asked them to share the gospel, and so that at nights they would have a big bonfire, and all the people would gather around in that village, and my dad would speak for two nights, and he would tell the whole story and tell them about how Christ died on the cross for their sins, invite them to give their hearts to Jesus. And they said, but the spirits, we have to have someone who's stronger than the spirits. And why didn't your God protect his son? What do you say to answer that? Well, they tried to explain, but the people were not ready to do that. And though they went to maybe 30 or 40 villages and it was exhausting work, there was not a single Benom Christian in 1966. That year, we came back to the U.S., and what had happened was that Lyndon Johnson had bombed eastern Cambodia because the North Vietnamese army was gathering there to go across into Vietnam, and Vietnam War was in full swing. And the Cambodian king was so angry, he ordered all Americans out of his country. And so we came back to the States, and there was still not a single Benom Christian. But there were Benom people in Vietnam, across the border. And so in 1966, my parents... Well, I started my pre-med training in Pennsylvania. My parents left for Vietnam. And for the next 18 months, they learned the third language that they had learned. The first was French. The second they had learned was Cambodian, read, write, and it's a script, so they had to learn how to read it too and speak it. And now they had to learn Vietnamese, which is a tonal language. It's very tricky. Matter of fact, one of my grandfather's favorite stories was that when he first came there, preached his first sermon, afterwards there was a church elder who came up to him and said, the church was very small. He said to him, "Oh, wonderful sermon, Pastor, but why did you preach on soy sauce? If you get the tone wrong, the word is different." And so anyway, it's a tricky language. But anyway, they learned, now they had to learn Vietnamese if they were going to reach the Benong in Vietnam. But God had a different plan. They finished the Vietnamese language study after 18 months, so they could read and write and speak. And one day on January 30th of 1968, it was the first day of the Chinese New Year, and before sunrise, the Viet Cong launched a surprise attack on cities all across Vietnam, including the city of Ban My Thuot in the central highlands of Vietnam. That was where my parents lived. Not only that, the battle began at the mission property. It lasted for 3 days. By the end of the second day, all of the missionary houses had been destroyed. On the third day of fighting, my parents and the other six missionaries who were trapped between the two armies tried to surrender under a white flag to the Viet Cong army. The soldiers shot the man carrying the flag, and then they came to the garbage pit where my parents and the other missionaries were sheltering and threw in a hand grenade. I was a second-year med student at that time, and 2 days after it happened, our mission informed me that my parents had been killed. And when I learned that, I was so angry. I went to my room and I screamed at God. Maybe you've done that too. But I asked them, why didn't you protect them? You sent them there. You know, God does things, and if you haven't learned this yet, I promise you, you will experience it. He does things that make no sense at the time. Why would he kill his messengers to a tribe that still had not turned to Christ? Who was going to go to the Benong people now? In the end, I found strength in the Bible verse my mother had cherished and had taught me, which you know, I'm sure, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. Brothers and sisters in the faith, if you want to be the light of the world, I promise you that God will ask you to trust him both through the best moments of your life and the worst. If you are willing to trust him in the worst times, God will work through you more wonderfully than you can possibly imagine. That's what Helen Roosevelt said. How many of you have read any of Helen Roosevelt's books? I urge you, I strongly urge you to find her books. She's long since gone to heaven. But during World War II, she and her family, they were Dutch. They hid more than 800 Jews from the Germans who had taken over Holland. When the Germans finally discovered them, they took her elderly mother and father to a German concentration camp where they both soon died. During those years, Helen and her sister were at a different camp and lived just hand to mouth, sleeping with thousands of women, Jewish women, who were being taken off to the gas chambers. And somehow or other, because she wasn't, I guess, Jewish, they let her continue to live in these terrible conditions. Finally, and they were starving to death. Finally, her sister became so weak that one of the guards murdered her. And then soon after that, maybe just weeks after that, the American soldiers came in and rescued them all. She recovered and began to tell the stories of how God had helped them through those years in the concentration camps. Just wonderful stories, amazing, miraculous stuff all the time. Anyway, one of the things, though, was she was preaching about that was the importance of forgiveness, of forgiving the people who had done these things. And she said to them, if you don't forgive, if you're not willing to forgive, you are the one who is going to suffer. And many people took that and heard that. But one day, a man came up to her and said, will you forgive me? It was the man who shot her sister. It was hard, but she forgave him. You know, the lesson of her life is that God, and this was one of her most memorable statement about suffering. She said, God never uses a person greatly until he has wounded them deeply. The privilege that he offers you is greater than the price you have to pay. That was her message. Not only did she speak to thousands of people in Germany after the war, in Holland after the war, in Europe after the war, God sent her all over the world. She spoke in churches in the United States. She spoke in churches in Africa. She came to our mission school, for goodness sakes, and she spoke in our mission school when I was a kid there.
What's her last name, Helen?
Helen Rosevere.
Thank you.
Helen Rosevere. Anyway, her books are still available on Amazon. Well, now we want to keep going on this story because God continued to bless us. Even though we had suffered, Becky had suffered, she had lost her father, but he brought us together now. We've been married 54 years, believe it or not. God led a loving family to adopt my three orphan siblings. He provided for my entire 8-year medical education with gifts from other people that I had that were strangers to me before. And he called us to serve as a doctor and nurse. We hoped that we could go back to Vietnam and Cambodia, but the war made that impossible. And God asked us to go to leave Cambodia and Vietnam in his hands and to go to Africa. But there's still a question that I need to answer. What happened to the Bonhomme? I mean, God had killed the messenger. In 1975, the North Vietnamese army invaded eastern Cambodia with their army, and they drove the Bonhomme people and other tribes who lived in eastern Cambodia out of their lands and across the border into Vietnam. To force them to flee, they burned their villages and they burned their rice fields. And all they could do, they could only take what they could carry because there were no roads there going across the border into Vietnam. So thousands and thousands of the Bonhomme, hundreds of thousands of them crossed, well, no, actually it wasn't that many, it was more than 30,000 crossed the border into Vietnam. They were sick, they were starving, they were exhausted. The Vietnamese government put them in abandoned American bases where they had shelter, but they had no water, no food, no blankets, and no medical care. But Vietnamese Christians, tribal Christians, missionaries brought them food, clothing, blankets, water, medicines, and the gospel. And when they heard the gospel, the Bonhomme people said, wait a minute. Where are the Thompsons? Those are our people. Why aren't they here? I mean, we're happy that you other white people are here, but where are the Thompsons? And so they told them. And when they told them how they had died, as they had come to reach the Bonhomme people in Vietnam, that something broke in their hearts. And they began to turn to Christ. First 1,000, then 10. And then 15, well, actually it stopped at 7 at that point. 7,000 of the Bonhomme turned to Christ. The next year, the North Vietnamese had taken over the country and they allowed the Bonhomme people to cross back into Cambodia. And so they came back into Cambodia, but when they came back, they brought the gospel and they began to tell their relatives and all of their friends. And we heard a few years later that many of Bonhomme were coming to faith in Christ in eastern Cambodia. Not too long ago, the Bonhomme Christians counted themselves. Today, there are 107,000. God knew that it would take somebody's blood to bring them to faith. And he knew it had to be my parents. Well, it's a wonderful story. And we, in 2009, Becky and I and her and my siblings, we were able to go back and see our parents' grave for the first time. We also got to go into eastern Cambodia and meet some of the Bonhomme Christians. Well, in 1975, I finished medical school. I graduated and I was accepted. Actually, it was earlier than that, 1971. And I started a residency in surgery in San Diego, and God gave us our first child. You know her, Rachel. That's what she looked like back then. And we applied to the Alliance to be missionaries and were accepted. So we asked them where they would like, where we could serve. And they said, well, a country that we'd never heard of. And the country was Gabon. Some of you may have never heard of Gabon. We certainly hadn't. And so they asked us to serve there and start a medical work. Could we do that? Becky was a nurse. I was a half-trained surgeon at that time. Later, I finished my residency. So after we accepted, we had to go to France for a year and learn French. That was just delightful. That was a great year. Got to travel to England, and we got to see lots of Europe and in between different holidays and so forth. And afterwards, we did tropical medicine. Finally, we arrived in Gabon in 1976 or 77. And so we were thinking, okay, they want us to build a hospital, and so we'll probably be in some big center, a city, and oh, this is going to be great. I can do my surgery, and Becky can start a nursing school. And so we arrived there, and mission said, well, you're not going to be in the capital city. You're going to be way down south. I mean, why build a hospital in the middle of nowhere? I mean, we were just shocked. And then we got on the road. I mean, the road was really interesting. And crossing bridges like this and dirt roads. And it took us 2 days to get down there. We followed our mission leader. And we had a Land Rover by then. And then we got to the river, the size of the Sacramento River. And that was the last obstacle. We had to cross on a missionary-built hand-pulled ferry, which I came to know very well. The really good news, though, was that our mission had appointed Becky and five other missionaries to work with us at our future hospital. And at the outset, he gave us the idea to do a medical survey in 100 local homes to see what the people's greatest medical needs were. And we knew they had tremendous spiritual needs, but there was a church then by then, and because missionaries had been in Gabon for many years, they had started churches, but there was no healthcare down there. So the missionaries who had built the dispensary, they had just retired, and it was horrible. I mean, it was dirty. It had no water. I mean, it did have water. They would carry buckets and fill a barrel, and carry it. Patients who came to the hospital had come with a bucket of water. There were also 100 goats that slept around the courtyard, and that's another story that you can read in among the many stories in this book. I won't tell it now. Well, the poverty and the disease burden that we found was just horrible. We decided that our first task was to do a survey in 100 homes, and what we found was just deeply shocking. One out of every 40 women who delivered died in childbirth. And let's compare that in the U.S., 20 women out of 100,000. One out of every four children died before the age of 5. And that was from malaria, from whooping cough, from polio, it's just unbelievable. Measles was the biggest killer. The major cause of death in men between 30 and 60 were strangulated hernias. The major death for women was childbirth. So after the survey, we decided we needed a nursing school, first of all. There was going to be a lot of work. And Becky began, and the other nurses started a nursing school. And over the next 4 years, they trained and discipled 20 nurses. It just kept going until it was hundreds, actually. And then after, it took us 3 years to build our first building, which was a maternity and surgery building, because men were dying mostly from strangulated hernias. And so it had a delivery room, an operating room, and we were able finally to perform safe C-sections and have good delivery space and so forth. And finally, in 1981, 4 years later, I performed the first operation. That was the longest 4 years of my life. I mean, before then, if I had a really a strangulated hernia, I had to put them in the back of my Land Rover and drive 250 miles up to Schweitzer Hospital, and where there were European non-Christian missionaries and a surgeon. But so this was a great blessing. But there were many discouraging days, many. And there are times, there were times when we ask this question. You maybe never ask this question. Does God know what he's doing? I mean, there were just so many strange things about where God had put us and what was happening around us. And at times we really wondered. But you know, God just kept us there. We kept working every day, getting up and doing what God allowed. And God provided for a few more buildings to be built. That about so that about 1994, I realized, and we realized, that we had become the major referral hospital for about a third of the country of Gabon. And our little hospital, and you know, that was a total number, about the total number of people that we were really caring for, providing services for, was around 200,000. And I was the only surgeon. Trauma from accidents was just horrible. I mean, look at this truck. This truck actually passed us as we were driving on a, you know, sturdy SUV. And we were going about 40 miles an hour, and they passed us like that. Well, imagine what happens when a truck like that rolls. Just horrendous injuries. And so my life, I love surgery, but I was finally, this point, working 120 hours a week. And I began praying. I said, Lord, please, please, Lord, we're so happy for this hospital, but I can't keep going like this. Please send another surgeon to help me. You know, I was just doing crazy things too, because we had all kinds of trauma. We had typhoid perforations of the intestine. We had burns. We had fractures of arms, legs, skulls. I was doing surgery in the chest for collections of fluid from tuberculosis. The list was just endless. I mean, I was the surgeon for the body and its contents, basically. And so I desperately needed help, and I kept praying, and for 2 years, God, 3 years, God did not answer or send anybody. We came to the States for 1 year. I spoke in about 30 churches, and there were lots of doctors in those churches, and I said, is there a surgeon here? You know, one or two would, you know, I really need you. Nobody came. Now, why would God do something like that? How do you pray in a moment like that? And so, one day, as I was praying, God said to me, now it was not an audible voice, but very clear in my mind, I heard these words, you train them, David. I thought, random thought, and said, Lord, going back to my prayer. And it came again, God said it again, you train them. I thought, how in the world am I going to do that? I'm already working 120 hours a week, and now I start a residency program in surgery, there's no way I could do that. But I kept praying, and I just trusted God. He had done so many things for us. I knew he would come through for us in some way. Well, the next year there was a conference put on by the Christian Medical and Dental Association in Kenya. And missionary doctors and nurses came for continuing medical education. And there I met 10 other surgeons who were dying too. They all had the same problem. And many surgeons were just quitting and leaving, and their hospitals had no surgeons. And so I told them what God had said to me, and we started talking, and we agreed that if we used the same textbooks that we had used when we became surgeons and went through residency, if we used the same way of examining and doing on the job training, in the operating room training, on rounds training, and all these things, we could train surgeons. And so we created something called the Pan-African Academy of Christian Surgeons. And our first resident came from Angola the next year. After 5 years of training, he passed his exams and was an excellent surgeon. Today, he is still serving in Angola at a Christian hospital. This logo, it was updated or improved, but I asked Joshua to come up with a logo idea, and this is what he came up with. So that was our logo for many years until recently. So that our graduate surgeons would also be evangelists and be able to disciple believers, we developed a two-track curriculum. One was surgery, and the other was biblical training and discipleship. It was just amazing what began to happen. Within a few years, I got my life back. And these were now residents here, and you see in this picture from Mali, Christian, all Christian men and women. Mali from Congo, and also from Madagascar, that was the beginning. But it didn't stop there. Now, while this was all going on, we also discovered that many people were coming to faith in at the hospital, but they were going back to their villages, and there was no discipling. So the Lord put it on our hearts to stop going to church in Bongolo and to drive 15 miles out to some of these villages and start holding Bible studies in homes, and that turned into churches. And that way, over a period of time, we were able to plant about 4 churches. So God just kept guiding us and helping us. Well, Becky and I are so grateful for the amazing things that God has done in our lives in ministry. I hope that these stories will really challenge you. This was the hospital 5 years before we left and went to Egypt. Because one day I got an invitation from the Anglican bishop in Egypt. He said, we have a Christian hospital in the center of the Nile Delta where 99% of the people are Muslim, and it's the only witness for that whole region. Would you come and help us start a surgical training program for Christian Egyptian doctors? And after a long time of praying, I said right away, yes. And Becky said, now just wait a minute there. We prayed for another few months, and then the Lord's told me where to go. So we went, and that was another blessing. It was in a big city of 400,000 people. We had to learn how to get around and buy tomatoes in Arabic and things like that. Becky got to be fairly fluent, but not me. But you know, what happened then was really crazy. The Pan-African Academy of Surgery just exploded across Africa in Christian hospitals. These are the training programs now. And we started with just one. Since 1967, PAX has trained, discipled, and graduated 209 Christian surgeons, African surgeons, all of whom, except two who died from cancer, are still in Africa and still proclaiming Jesus to their patients. Currently, we have the same number of residents in training. These are stories about how God partners with his servants, how God takes one person and then makes it 2, and then 4, and then 8, and then 12, and it just goes on, and how God builds his church. And I really want to help you to not think that a church this size cannot change the world. One of you can. One. Because God does the multiplication. Bongolo Hospital and PAX are stories about how God partners with us to bring his light to every tribe and nation. You know, we're not in charge. He is. He is on this whole project. God's blessing on this church, Westside Church of Reading, and on us individually are important goals. And on our community is important. But unless we are obeying Jesus and taking the gospel and sending the light to those who live in darkness, whether near or far, we are turning a deaf ear to Christ's last command. You have seen today what God can do with one faithful follower of Christ, turning them into many, one missionary to 20. May the Lord give us here in this church the faith and the love to trust him and support those whom God calls to serve in this capacity as missionaries, as lights to the world. Let's pray.